The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The Seattle City Council's Public Safety and Human Services Committee met on September 22, 2020. Among other business, the council members heard a presentation on supervised consumption facilities. We'll hear some of that audio in a moment. But first, on September 22nd, the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction released European Drug Report 2020. This first question from Inder Bulgarin, a reporter with a Spanish news agency, is worth hearing.
I would like to know if a drug getting sick of COVID-19. And after 25 years of monitoring the drug problem in Europe, the research has been not successful at all.
Gracias.
We see a situation, more problems and more problems every time.
Thank you, Inder.
Do you think we need a new paradigm?
Okay, Alexei, would you like to answer the question? Thank you, Inder.
Yes, thank you very much, Inder, for the two questions. The first question is, in terms of data and facts, we don't have any yet any precise data regarding the proportion of COVID cases that were taking place among people who are using drugs. What we can say, what we can imagine, is that some of the people who are using drugs present certain series of vulnerabilities, including health vulnerabilities, which may have potentially been exposing them to more risks if they were infected by the COVID virus to develop a more serious form of the illness. But what we know is that during the COVID pandemic, the professionals from the treatment centers and from harm reduction services have made the difference together and in partnership with the clients. So I think what the pandemic has showed and revealed is the possibility for a new alliance between practitioners and clients. And this is how certainly we have managed to maintain people in the treatment system, to provide additional help and assistance, including additional harm reduction services to be closer from the new needs of some of those clients that were more exposed to difficulties due to the lockdown. And we will see in the coming months with the further analysis of epidemiological data if there has been a percentage of those clients that have been touched by the coronavirus. Regarding your second question, I think we can look at it in a different way. The starting point, why have we been created 25 years ago? We've been created as a direct consequence of the heroin epidemic and the huge number of death cases from overdose that were taking place or happening in the main cities in all the EU countries. So the mission of the center was first and foremost to provide an accurate picture of the situation, the needs, and the best ways to answer or to address the problem. And if we look at the situation at the drug policy in the European Union over the last 25 years, you can see a dramatic increase of the cooperation, exchange of best practice, exchange of comparable information between the member states, and this in turn I support the adoption of more common and shared approaches of the problem. And in parallel, you have a dramatic decrease of the number of new cases of HIV or AIDS cases related to drug use. We have seen a dramatic reduction, not yet sufficient, but a dramatic reduction in the number of drug-related deaths because of infections, because of overdoses, and also indirect drug-related death. So overall, a very positive picture of the way in which in the European Union we have addressed the problem, joining the efforts, evidence-based, and that is characterized, and it is the main region in the world that is doing that for more than 20 years, a balanced approach combining public health and also law enforcement. Now, what we monitor, thanks to this joint effort from all the EU member states, supported by the European Commission and the other European institutions, is the fact that the drug phenomenon is changing. And what is another characteristic is that the drug phenomenon is much more disseminated throughout the entire society, and at the same time, it is less visible. So instead of talking about a failure or the absence of results, I would say we have started addressing a problem as it was emerging 25 years ago. Now it is changing. This is why it is time to change and adapt further the approach. And this is why we welcome the proposal made by the European Commission for a new pact in Europe, a new strategy, a new agenda on drugs, based on the evidence that we and other agencies are collecting in order to adjust to the new emerging reality and the new threats that are associated. Thank you.
That was Alexei Gudzel, the executive director of the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction, answering a question from reporter Inder Bulgarin at a news conference on the release of the new European Drug Report 2020. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The Seattle City Council's Public Safety and Human Services Committee met on September 22, 2020. Among other business, the council members heard a presentation on supervised consumption facilities. We're going to hear some of that audio now. Speakers include Lisa Herbold, member of the Seattle City Council, Brad Feingood, strategic advisor at Public Health Seattle and King County, Jesse Rollins, public policy manager for the Public Defenders Association in Seattle, Mark Cook, ACLU Washington policy director with the Washington Campaign for Smart Justice, Richard Waters, MD, physician and site medical director at NeighborCare Health, Housing and Street Outreach, Michael Ninberg, executive director of the Hepatitis Education Project, and Lisa Etter Carlson, co-founder and director of programs at Aurora Commons in Seattle.
So Brad Feingood, Public Health, Seattle, King County. Just a little bit of the general overdose numbers in King County. Overdoses continue to rise, and they've continued to rise year over year since we held our task force in 2015. The biggest category that has continued to rise is the individuals who have died of overdoses that have multiple drugs in their system. What we're seeing is a continuing complexity of overdose numbers, overdose deaths, and people who are using drugs that have negative consequences. So you will see that there are two numbers that are going up drastically in our community. This is where certain drugs are involved in people's system, and I'm happy to come back at a later time to talk more about that. But the two most prominent drugs that are on the rise in people's system that have led to overdose deaths are both methamphetamine and fentanyl. Fentanyl, very much so countywide. Heroin and methamphetamine much more has been an issue in overdose deaths in the city, in the city of Seattle. So here's a little bit of numbers of geographic impacts of overdose deaths. So you'll see that fentanyl overdose deaths are more predominant in the rest of the, in the outlying cities of the county, where 40% of fentanyl involved deaths are in the city of Seattle, not so much in the urban core, but spread throughout Seattle. Almost 60% is through the rest of the county. When you look at non-fentanyl involved overdose deaths, and those are primarily with heroin and methamphetamine, those continue to see significant impacts, the most significant impacts in the city of Seattle. And that continues to be very much clustered in the urban core. That is my quick update, and I want to make sure to share time with everybody else.
Thank you, Brad. So what's the proposal? I understand that the recommended model has shifted over the last several months. And that's what we're here to talk about is what's new in the campaign and in the proposal that we are we're seeking to support funding with the funding that the city has put aside for this purpose.
Thank you, Chair Herbold, and thank you, Brad, for giving us that information on local statistics around our overdose crisis. So I wanted to start off with introductions. So we are going to have a presentation today from Yes to SES, so Yes to Safe Consumption Spaces, Seattle King County. So we're presenting on local strategies for implementing SES here in Seattle. So I wanted to first just introduce myself. Again, my name is Jesse Rollins. Thank you, Chair Herbold, for having us today. And thank you, other council members, for being here as well. My name is Jesse Rollins again, and I'm the Public Policy Manager at the Public Defender Association. And I will let Mark introduce himself next.
Good morning. Thank you, council members. My name is Mark Cook. I'm an attorney with the ACLU of Washington, which is a member of the SES campaign.
And then if we could have Dr. Waters introduce himself.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Richard Waters. I'm a primary care physician with NeighborCare, speaking on my own today, and work with people who use drugs and those experiencing homelessness.
Thank you, Dr. Waters. And then Michael.
Hi, good morning. Michael Lindberg. I'm the executive director of HEP, a nonprofit that has been working in Seattle for almost 30 years, primarily with underserved and marginalized populations.
And then last but not least, Lisa.
Hi, everyone. I'm a long-term North Seattle resident, a mother, a homeowner, and co-founder of Aurora Commons here in North Seattle.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for introducing yourselves. So we are going to be very efficient with our presentation today and just hit high levels and try to leave some time at the end for questions. So we're kind of going to give a brief description of our Yes to SES timeline, what we're talking about for local strategy for SES implementation, a legal landscape, some perspectives with healthcare folks and social service providers, and then questions and comments. So I'm going to turn it over to Mark to start us off with our timeline of SES here in Seattle King County.
Thank you, Jesse, and apologies if there's some dog barking noise. So we actually just hit the four-year anniversary last week for when the Seattle King County Opiate Task Force released its findings, which seems like a really long time ago. But as you just saw, the need is still there. And we are still committed to trying to get this public health intervention implemented. But shortly after the report came out, the King County Board of Health endorsed this practice via a resolution in 2017, which really put this on a very strong legal footing, which then led into some budgetary decisions, which I think Jesse was going to give a little more detail on.
Yeah, so just we wanted to recognize that this legislative body has shown a lot of leadership around SES. In particular, in 2018, through y'all's budget authority, allocated $1.3 million. And then in 2019, allocated an additional $100,000 to total $1.4 million. And then in 2020, Chair Herbold, and being a very brilliant in the legislative details and process, caught that the $100,000 that was allocated in 2019 was actually not included in the city's finance general. So again, appreciate Chair Herbold for marrying the $1.3 million with the $100,000.
And all credit goes to Christina Cotillo's in my office for finding that oversight.
Christina's great as well. So moving along, so as you know, what we have been pushing for, Yes to SES, is we have Historically talked about implementing two pilot SDSs, one in Seattle and one in King County, is what the recommendations, the Heroin and Prescription Opiate Addiction Task Force recommended. And much of that advocacy was around a standalone site. And what we're here today is to discuss an evolved strategy for implementing SDS. So our evolved strategy would be implementing SCS, so supervised or safer consumption services at existing low barrier social service locations that serve people who use drugs. So what we know actually is that unsafe or unsupervised consumption already occurs at many of these social service locations. And so what we're here today is to advocate for support and implementation for SES at existing social service locations, in addition to, unsafe and unsupervised consumptions already happening at these locations. 80% of survey respondents in the most recent syringe program survey, 80% again, talked about how they would use SES. They would use supervised consumption services. In 2016, 15 months after the city started its needle collection pilot, over 5,000 needles were removed from public space. And I just wanted to highlight that there have been, since the task force made its recommendation, 754 people inside Seattle have died from fatal overdoses. What's super fascinating is that 14% of countywide overdose rates are affected by people experiencing homelessness. And comparing that to the total population, only 0.5% of King County's population is experiencing homelessness. So that's 14% versus 0.5%. So again, just highlighting the disproportionality around overdoses and how SDSs would really be a beneficial public health approach for vulnerable folks that use drugs. So now I'm going to turn it over to Mark to talk just a little bit about the kind of legal landscape of SDS.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you, council members. I'll be very brief. Just wanted to kind of point back to the 2016 task force report, which really did, try to delve into some of the legal questions that would come with opening up this type of public health intervention. But I think the big thing to remember is that when it comes to public health and public safety regulation, that legally speaking, those are local and state issues and not federal issues. And the law is quite clear that, local governments and states don't need to be in lockstep with federal law. And, examples of that would be things like needle exchanges or marijuana laws. There are much more clear-cut federal drug crimes happening in Seattle every day, thousands of times when people are purchasing marijuana, which continues to be an illegal federal crime. So when it comes to implementing something that is arguably not even a federal drug crime at all, based on this federal crack house statute, it's very unfortunate when people raise the specter of federal law enforcement as a reason not to move forward with this. So really just wanted to remind this body that you have great authority when it comes to regulating issues of public health and public safety, and feel strongly that a consumption space and consumption services fit squarely within that. And if you're looking for a really good example of how that law plays out, I would point to the Seattle City Attorney's amicus brief that was filed recently in the case out of Philadelphia that was looking at these exact issues. And in that case, which is still ongoing and it's not binding on Seattle, the judge made quite clear that this notion that a consumption space violates federal law is not correct. The intent of these facilities is public health and to connect people with treatment and services. It is not to facilitate drug crimes. So I would just reiterate that there is very strong legal ground for these facilities, and City of Seattle should move forward. It's been much too long. These money has been sitting there for years. Please put it to good use.
And just to put a finer point on Mark, thanks again, is that the city of Seattle has kind of continuously and historically advanced policies in definement with federal government. And so we would continue to ask that such policies be pushed for vulnerable folks that use drugs as well. So now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Waters to give his perspective around healthcare components with SCS.
Yeah, and thanks, Jesse, and thanks, Mark, and thanks to the council members for having us. So from a healthcare provider perspective, I fully support this. This makes a lot of sense for individuals' health, for public health, and should also be conceptualized as a strategy to reduce drug use overall. Certainly for individual health, we've got needle exchanges that are kind of a proven intervention to reduce things like the transmission of viral hepatitis or HIV. And especially for folks who are the most vulnerable, who don't have safe places to use, SCS is kind of continues this continuum and can reduce those risks further. So certainly reducing fatal overdoses, but also further reducing viral hepatitis spread, HIV, but also kind of both costly to human health and to healthcare costs, dangerous bacterial infections, heart valve infections, has the potential to improve those. Most notably, the idea of pairing this in existing sites where there can be pathways readily available to access drug treatment programs is very exciting, and I think will be potentially very effective at reducing overall drug use in the long term. Some may lament this idea and say, why don't we just go all in on drug treatment programs and skip this idea of a safe consumption site? And I think that perspective misses the idea that, especially for the most marginalized, building trust and relationships over the long term is key and essential for kind of durable engagement into drug reduction programs and to kind of decrease harm. So I think these complement each other completely. And then certainly the kind of other benefit is just bringing existing drug use that is already happening in safe ad hoc drug consumption spaces or unsafe and ad hoc drug consumption spaces indoors, out of the public eye, to places that are safe, welcoming, non-stigmatizing, and again, can improve engagement in the long term with the clients that we already serve. Thank you.
And while we're transitioning to our last slide, introducing Lisa and Michael, I will also just add that the city, the executive has kind of continued to label budget constraints around moving forward with SCS. And so we don't find those budget constraints as legitimate with this evolved strategy. We believe that the resources available would be sufficient for implementing SCS at existing social service locations. And we're going to hear from two providers very briefly about their interest in implementing SCS, safer consumptions, practices, or services at their social service location. So Lisa and Michael, I'm not sure who wants to go first.
Yes, thank you, Council. I am here to unabashedly plead with you to release the money to SCS because I know with my whole heart and 18 years of experience accompanying folks who are living unsheltered, engaging in survival, street-based sex work, and consuming drugs, that this is absolutely the moral thing to do. What I witness every day are 60 to 125 unique resilient citizens of your city who do not want to die, but rather want desperately to live and to make meaning of their lives. And I'm here to tell you that what is behind our own walls, each and every one of us on this call, is hurting at times and is lonely at times. Only we have the privilege of hiding how we cope behind four walls, and the precious folks who need SCS do not have that privilege. They're outdoors and they're pushed more and more away from our society and absolutely told and treated as though they are expendable. What we are saying to you now, Council, is that safe consumption spaces are among us already. They are places like Aurora Commons, like HEP, that engage in contextualized, decolonized community, story-driven care where folks are met where they're at and treated as if they matter. It's within these spaces that precious folks can come out of the shadows and access comprehensive care in a way and at places where they feel safe and not condemned. I want to be really clear, safe consumption spaces co-located in people's communities is not only a kindness, but it is the right public health response that we need. I have seen this work firsthand. Funding this will not only prevent hundreds of unnecessary preventable deaths of precious people, it will also make our communities safer, my own young children's parks safer, and this is absolutely the kindness that we need right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks so much, Lisa. Michael, do you want to briefly talk about your perspective around SES and how you could possibly incorporate using this funding at your at Hepatitis Education Project?
Yes, I would love to. And thank you, Lisa, for your eloquent words there and everyone else. I think there's unanimity in understanding that we have a problem that needs to be addressed. We have monies that have been set aside that have not been allocated. And organizations like ours, like Aurora Commons, where we do things like provide naloxone. We distributed more than 2,300 doses of naloxone last year at HEP, and our participants, 75% of whom report living homeless in the last year, reversed 650 overdoses in 2019. So we have the tools to really make this problem better. And it's not just about the supervised consumption. It's about, as Dr. Waters said, getting people other services that they want or need. We provide a low-barrier buprenorphine program at HEP in conjunction with the Country Doctor Federally Qualified Health Center. We do testing and linkage to care for hepatitis and HIV, and we get people who are not getting these services anywhere else the services that they need. So I would also strongly urge you, Chair Herbold, to do what you can to release these funds to organizations that can actually put them to work and prevent some of those 754 overdose deaths that have occurred since these monies were originally allocated. Thank you very much.
You just heard Lisa Herbold, member of the Seattle City Council, Brad Feingood with Public Health Seattle and King County, Jesse Rollins with the Public Defenders Association, Mark Cook from ACLU Washington, Dr. Richard Waters from Neighbor Care Health, Michael Ninberg from the Hepatitis Education Project, and Lisa Etter Carlson from Aurora Commons. We heard a presentation on supervised consumption facilities. In spite of opposition from the current president, Seattle and other cities and counties around the U.S. continue to work on saving lives by moving forward with plans to set up supervised consumption facilities and overdose prevention sites. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's new video project, Claiming the Moral High Ground. Find links at drugtruth.net or search for Becker's Buds and Claiming the Moral High Ground on YouTube. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.